have a son. To kill Lars, that's why, Pancho answered herself. What should I do about it? Should I do anything? Warn Lars? Try to help Mandy? Show she's got somebody she can depend on? Or just stay the hell out of the whole ugly mess? Pancho gazed out at the tired, worn, slumped ringwall mountains of Alphonsus. They look like I feel, she said to herself. Weary, worn down. What should I do? Without thinking about it, she called out, Decor scheme, deep space. The lunar surface abruptly disappeared. Pancho was in the midst of empty space, stars and glowing nebulas and whirling galaxies stretching out into the blackness of infinity. Saturn vicinity, she called. The ringed planet appeared before her eyes, hovering in emptiness, a splendid, eye-dazzling oblate sphere of delicate pastel colors with those impossible bright white rings floating around its middle. That's where Sis is, Pancho thought, hundreds of millions of kilometers away. Abruptly, she shook her head, as if to clear it. Versailles, Hall of Mirrors, she called, and instantly was in the French palace, staring at her own reflections. What should I do about Mandy? She asked herself again. Then a new thought struck her. What do I want to do? Me, myself. What do I want to do? Once, Pancho had been a roughneck astronaut, a tomboy who dared farther and played harder than all the others. But ever since her younger sister was struck down by cancer so many years ago, so many lifetimes ago, Pancho had lived her life for others, her sister. Then Dan Randolph came along, hired her as an astronaut, and, as he lay dying, bequeathed his share of Astro Corporation to her. Ever since, she had been fighting Dan's fights, striving to hold Astro together, to make it profitable, to keep it out of Humphrey's clutching paws. And now, Amanda? What about me? She wondered. What do I want to be when I grow up? She studied her reflection in the nearest mirror and saw beyond the floor-length party skirt and glittering lamé blouse, beyond the cosmetic therapies, to the gawky, gangling African-American from West Texas that lay beneath the expensive exterior. What do you want out of life, girl? Her reflection shook its head at her. Doesn't matter. You inherited this responsibility from Dan Randolph. It's on your shoulders now. Mandy, Humphreys, even this guy from Nairobi Industries. It's all part of the game you're in, whether you like it or not. What you want doesn't matter. Not until this game is finished, one way or the other. Especially not now. The humper's starting to peck away at Astro again. He's starting the war again. I thought it was all finished and over with 8 years ago, but Humphreys is starting again. Third freighter in as many weeks, according to this morning's report. He's only knocked off unmanned freighters so far, but this is just the beginning. He's probing to see how I'm going to react. And it's not just Humphreys either, Pancho reminded herself as she walked slowly along the mirrored corridor. It's the whole dang world! Earth's just starting to recover from the greenhouse cliff a little bit. Raw materials from the belt are so blasted cheap they're providing the basis for an economic comeback. But if Humphreys gets complete control of the belt, he'll jack up the prices to wherever he wants them. He doesn't care about Earth or anybody besides himself. He wants a monopoly. He wants a goddamn empire for himself. You've got responsibilities, lady, she said to her reflection. You got no time to feel sorry for yourself. Acropolis, she commanded, striding back to her bedroom through colonnades of graceful fluted columns, the ancient city of Athens visible beyond them, lying in the hot summer sun beneath a sky of perfect blue. Once in her bedroom, Pancho made two phone calls, one to the investment firm in New York that she always used to check out potential business partners or rivals. The other was a personal call to Big George Ambrose in his room in the very same Hotel Luna. She was surprised when the phone's synthesized voice told her that George Ambrose had already left Selene. He was returning to Ceres.
"Find him, wherever he is," Pancho snapped at the phone. "I want to talk to him."
Chota Monastery, Nepal. The first thing Nobuhiko Yamagata did once he returned to Earth following Humphrey's party was to visit his revered father, which meant an overnight flight in a corporate jet to Patna on the Ganges, and then an arduous haul by tilt-rotor halfway up the snowy slopes of the Himalayas. Saito Yamagata had founded the corporation in the earliest years of the space age and made it into one of the most powerful industrial giants in the world. It had been Saito's vision that built the first solar power satellites and established factories in Earth orbit. It had been Saito who partnered with Dan Randolph's Astro Corporation back in those primitive years when the frontier of human endeavor barely reached to the surface of the moon. When Nobuhiko was a young man just starting to learn the intricacies of corporate politics and power, Saito was stricken with an inoperable brain tumor. Instead of stoically accepting his fate, the elder Yamagata had himself frozen, preserved cryonically in liquid nitrogen, until medical science advanced enough to remove the tumor without destroying his brain. Young Nobu, then, was in command of Yamagata Corporation when the greenhouse cliff plunged the world into global disaster. Japan was struck harder than most industrial nations by the sudden floods that inundated coastal cities and the mammoth storms that raged out of the ocean remorselessly. Earthquakes shattered whole cities, and tsunamis swept the Pacific. Many of the nations that sold food to Japan were also devastated by the greenhouse cliff. Croplands died in withering droughts or were carved away by roaring floods. Millions went hungry, and then tens of millions starved. Still, Saito waited in his sarcophagus of liquid nitrogen, legally dead, yet waiting to be revived and returned to life. Under Nobuhiko's direction, Yamagata Corporation retreated from space and spent every bit of its financial and technical power on rebuilding Japan's shattered cities. Meanwhile, he learned that he could use nanomachines to safely destroy the tumor in his father's brain. The virus-sized devices could be programmed to take the tumor apart, molecule by molecule. Nanotechnology was banned on Earth. Fearful mobs and acquiescent politicians had driven the world's experts in nanotech off the Earth altogether. Nobu understood that he could bring his father's preserved body to Selene and have the nanotherapy done there. But he decided against it. He did not stay his hand because of the horrendous political pressures that would be brought to bear on Yamagata Corporation for using a technology that was illegal on Earth, nor even because of the moral and religious outcry against such a step, although Nobuhiko publicly blamed those forces for his decision. In truth, Nobu dreaded the thought of his father's revival, fearing that his father would be displeased with the way he was running the corporation. Saito had never been an easy man to live with. His son was torn between family loyalty and his desire to keep the reins of power in his own hands. In the end, family loyalty won. On the inevitable day when the corporation's medical experts told Nobu that his father's tumor could be safely removed without using nanomachines, Nobu felt he had no choice but to agree to the procedure. The medical experts had also told him with some reluctance that although persons could be physically revived from cryonic suspension, their minds were usually as blank as a newborn baby's. Long immersion at cryogenic temperature erodes the synaptic connections in the brain's higher centers. No matter that the person was physically an adult, a cryonic reborn had to be toilet trained, taught to speak, to walk, to be an adult, all over again. And even then, the mind of the reborn would probably be different from the mind of the person who had gone into the cryonic suspension. Subtly different, perhaps. But Nobuhiko was warned not to expect his father to be exactly the same personality he'd been before he had died. With some trepidation, Nobu had his father revived, and personally